I'd like to give a talk called Ordinary Movement. Just today I found out that one of my favorite descriptions of enlightenment that just came to me one day when a good friend who also teaches Dharma said, "What do you think enlightenment is? How would you describe it?" And the word ordinariness came out of my mouth, and it felt true. So knowing that we're talking about something that can't be described, it's just a word that doesn't say it all, but it does say something, ordinariness, nothing specialness. And just today I found out that ordinary liberation is actually a phrase that's used in one of the Tibetan Buddhist traditions in the Mahamudra. And I like when insights happen that way around. The insight happens and then later you find out that experts agree. So there's not a question of imagination or pretense getting in the way. And I like the example of being in conversation and there's a question from one side and a response from the other side that brings about an insight. Very relevant to the format that we have here in the gathering. And I'm delighted to begin the talk by reading a poem translated from Rumi. Poem that I came across many years ago and tried to come across many times in the years in between, and then did come across it finally yesterday. So Rumi was a Sufi mystic who loved to love. The poem is given the title Unmarked Boxes. How is it to hear? Is it easy to hear, hard to understand? It's okay? I can't really see you, what you're saying. It's dark, but you can hear, okay. Don't grieve. Grieving means when you've lost something and you feel you to go through a process of letting go by feeling the pain of the loss and crying. Don't grieve. Anything you lose comes round in another form. The child weaned from mother's milk now drinks wine and honey mixed. So the child may be sad to let go of the mother's milk. The mother may be sad to let go of that time of mothering. But then the child grows to drink something else delicious. God's joy moves from unmarked box to unmarked box, from cell to cell. As rainwater down into the ground, as roses up from ground. Now it looks like a plate of rice and fish. Now a cliff covered with vines. Now a horse being saddled. It hides within these till one day it cracks them open. I don't want to make anyone fearful. Here's what's behind, hear what's behind what I say. Ta-ta-ta-tum, ta-tum, ta-ta-tum. There's the light gold of wheat in the sun. And the gold of bread made from that wheat. I have neither. I'm only talking about them. As a town in the desert looks up at stars on a clear night. When we come for Dharma teachings and we come on purpose to hear, to receive, to absorb Dharma teachings. Teachings about that without which nothing else could be. We need to notice how we relate to the idea of teachings, the idea of Dharma. There's a tendency to think that it's going to be something special. It's going to be something foreign or exotic that I'm going to have to become. I'm going to have to emigrate to that country. Or it's going to come crashing down on me and destroy my life. Or it's going to lift me up so that I live with the angels. If we could recover the kind of seriousness of intent that's in there, willing to receive teachings that could destroy who I think I am, that could make me move to another country, that could lift me up out of suffering forever, and leave out the kind of specialness factor, the exotic, the foreign. So that we could hear that what resonates with us is resonating inside and outside at one time. So there can be an openness to hear what we've never heard before, and yet it's somewhere familiar. It somewhere moves us. And that being moved inwardly by something that's happening outside us is important and ordinary. It's something, what I mean to say in this moment by ordinary, being moved by something we've never thought before. Being moved by something that doesn't just simply agree with what I already think. It doesn't agree with my opinion and then I feel good about it. Something else is happening. So even if I've heard similar words before, there's something that moves us. And it's nothing special, because it's what we could live. It seems special because maybe we went looking for it, and it hasn't seemed to happen very often. But there's also in that being moved a kind of, I think it's built in, a recognition that this is daily bread. And sometimes with that, there can be tears being touched, being moved so deeply. Because there is a kind of sadness that we haven't been aware of movement so deep in our being before. And I'd love for us to leave room for two things. Leaving room for, yes, sometimes something that we never felt moved. And it's not a shame. It's not like, oh my goodness, I'm 45 or I'm 25 or I'm 105 and I never before realized or was touched in that way. Just the opposite. It only took 45 years. It only took, let's see if I can count now, 25 years of practice for this movement to come. And to have its ordinariness as well as its newness. So that's one thing we could be open for. But I'd also like if we could be open that we ourselves, as we are already, are a vast movement through life, of which we're mostly unaware, which we mostly don't give our credit to us. We're busy with our worries and our hurries. Many times people will try to think about their spiritual practice, whether they've just begun today or whether they've been going for decades. And the usual way of assessing, the usual way of trying to find out, is it going well, is number one, the number of thoughts in my mind. And number two, what I think about my psychology, what I think about my psychological freedom, how I think I'm doing in terms of psychological freedom. Do I still get angry when someone calls me something negative? Do I still get intimidated by someone who has a strong presence of authority? Do I still catch myself being arrogant and only a week too late realize that I just missed an opportunity for a friendship? Those are important issues, but it's not the only thing we should tune into when we tune into ourselves. And it might be even important to take a break of maybe a year if you've been busy with that theme and watching yourself how you're doing. How many thoughts and how's my psychology? How would it be to just have a break for a day or a month or a year? Just to find out if there's another way of feeling ourselves and our depth. Jay Krishnamurti is another person whose words I love to read to hear kind of confirmation of my own insights. And so today I opened one of his books. Which one is it? Let's see. This Light in Oneself, True Meditation. The difficulty with Krishnamurti is reading him before some experience, it can seem inaccessible what he's talking about, because he's just describing a kind of absolute state. And occasionally giving us ways that we could be that clear and honest and open. Krishnamurti talks about what he calls undisciplined order. And that's what I would call today this ordinary movement. He says that what we usually do is we try to create order by sticking to an idea. So, for example, we may find ourselves, in his example, he says, we may find ourselves experiencing selfishness and we immediately have the idea, as soon as we notice selfishness, and one reason that it's almost impossible to notice selfishness is that we immediately have the opposite idea of unselfishness. And so we're kind of stretched between the idea of selfishness as wrong and the idea of unselfishness as right. And we're therefore unable to just be in contact with simple, ordinary selfishness. We've lost touch with our experience and we're in this polarity of ideas. Because selfishness is wrong and not allowed, we can't allow it. We can't be in touch with it. And so it goes on and we're blind to it. So he says thought in this way actually creates disorder. Our original intention was to make ourselves more orderly, more harmonious by not allowing selfishness. And so it's not that we want to be more and more selfish, of course, that's not the idea. But we do want to be able to be in touch when there is selfishness, as simply as we can, as an ordinary experience. With a lot of not knowing selfishness, and we don't know exactly maybe all the factors that made that happen. Krishnamurti makes the very kind of daring statement that just simply by leaving out the opposite of selfishness, the perception of selfishness is enough. He says the perception, that very perception, without the opposite, the perception brings order. So he doesn't mean order in terms of obedience to an idea. He means a more fluid, dynamic harmony that has creativity in it. And getting stuck between our experience and how we think our experience is wrong, and especially what's happening in our thinking and our psychology, we don't let ourselves actually feel anything, because it's immediately right or wrong. We are immediately stuck between the two ideas. And so this stops us from actually going to the root of the pain that's happening. We believe that selfishness is bad, and our experience of selfishness is that it's painful. And we just let it be painful. We're brought to the root of it. The experience itself, though unenlightened, the experience itself contains its response. And so we start to be able to find that our life is trustworthy, partly because nothing much special is really happening. It's just ordinary selfishness. And then a simple meeting, and then simple harmony. So the daring statement that Krishnamurti continues with, order can come into being only when thought, which is necessary in certain areas, has no place in the psychological world. Order can come into being, so harmony starts to arise when we give less and less chance for thought to invade and attack our psyche and our psychological experience, and to think that we know what's happening, to think that we know what's right, how it should be, how it shouldn't be. Rather, with trusting the workability of our ordinary lives, that nothing is too much for us. So another way to say ordinary is our great capacity, our great resilience, our great capacity to find a way within any situation, with any emotion, with any psychological history, with any amount of thoughts in the mind. That great capacity that has been proven time and again by we human beings, by us human beings, can be taken as ordinary. It can be taken as possible for any of us at any time. So we start to let our brain, our head, be more free of its job that it's taken on. And that starts to let aliveness come through in different ways. Are there any questions or comments so far? I'd really like to welcome you, even if it's a word in English that you didn't understand, or the echo blocked out a word or whatever, or any question. When we start to invite quiet, we get to know restlessness. Inviting quiet starts to help us know how much restlessness is going on in us and outside of us. In two ways, so let's be clear. Sometimes it's that first day on retreat kind of phenomenon where we're trying to be silent and the mind is really busy. And it seems that we're thinking more thoughts than we've ever thought before, more thoughts per minute, per second, than we ever thought possible. That's one way that inviting quiet helps us get to know restlessness. It's an invitation. Invitation to quiet invites getting to know restlessness, busyness. And also, and being in Sarnath this year, after having been here for the previous 14 years, the 15th time this year for this program, as well as many times before that, the first time I came here in 1987, we could just roam around the archaeological ruins like children. And I felt like a child playing hide and go seek. Could go down into all the structures, and there was hardly anyone. There was actually no one else but the group I was with, a group of 20-year-old students. There was a wonderful, innocent freedom and connection to the powerful practice that had gone on, different human beings, thousands of human beings, being in this very place on the planet, sleeping in those little tiny cells and eating from that little kitchen. And each year, more walls around the archaeological site, which surely is worthy of being preserved, and yet something goes missing. And then not just the walls, but the walls of buses down not just one side of the road, but now two sides of the road. Less than 100 years ago, a woman was staying in Varanasi. Actually, she was working at the Krishnamurti school there, and she was a friend, colleague, and student of Krishnamurti, who was alive at that time. And she came to meet her other teacher in Sarnath, and the way to come at that time was walking on the pilgrim path. And she talks about the quality of walking on that path, that she could pick up the feeling of the seriousness, the practice, the simplicity, the devotion. And when she got to Sarnath, the quality that she felt with her other teacher was spaciousness. And until the last few years, I think that would have been the first word any of us would have said about the place. Curiously enough, for myself, being here this year, which seems to be the most crowded on the streets that I remember. The opposite of spacious. I would also like to acknowledge that what I feel inside the hall is a very deep and powerful sense of that spaciousness, and the sense of that we can just feel it. We can just feel the centuries, the millennia of practice that's gone on here, not only in the Buddhist tradition, but in Hindu, Jain, and as well as Muslim traditions. And so the invitation to quiet sometimes does bring us in touch with quiet directly. In contrast to the seemingly not quiet out there. And then that quietness ends up being so powerful that we would hardly call it quietness. So the different kinds of movement, being moved, that can happen. Gautam Buddha talks about what in the tradition are called hindrances or obstacles. Here we have the buses, a real obstacle course physically to get from food to hall and hall to food. So an obstacle is what's in the way in your path. Today I just want to talk about a beautiful, powerful metaphor that he gave for restlessness and freedom from restlessness. So busyness, not quiet. Being moved in a way that's also very ordinary, we're all used to it. Being moved in a way that's not free. Being moved in a way that's painful and tied to the past, like the way an animal sometimes is tied to a stake, and so it can only move in the same circle. And sometimes even we wrap ourselves around the stake, so we don't even have that circle. He talked about restlessness, and with restlessness, comma, remorse. So restlessness is the famous label for that hindrance or obstacle, something that comes up when we're on the way. It gets in our way when we're on our way. And so, by the way, in a way, we can actually take the hindrances, the obstacles, as a sign that we actually are on our way. It's what happens when we're walking our path, when we're going deep, when we're letting life stretch us so that we do start to experience the vastness of our life and the depth of it. What will happen is obstacles will come. One of those is called restlessness, comma, remorse. Remorse is about the past, something that's already happened that we can't change. And there's pain around that. And in a deceivingly short line, the Buddha gives a very rich image. Restlessness as being like slavery, being a slave. And so we could hear that and say, oh yeah, restlessness like being a slave. But if we actually think about what it is to be a slave, just carefully for a moment. The way the Buddha describes it is that we're not self-dependent, we're dependent on others. What does that mean? It means, as a slave, we have no resources of our own, inner or outer. We don't decide where we go, when we go, and what we do when we go there. We're told forcefully when to go, where to go, what to do, how long to do it. Isn't it a powerful metaphor? If we don't pause for a moment and take it in, we would just keep flying by with our busyness. Oh yeah, got it. Restlessness, slavery, check. Out of the five hindrances, it's really, I would say, the image that's given, it's the hardest one. So there could be being in debt for craving, there could be being very unwell for ill will. There could be being in prison for inertia, lack of energy. And there's crossing a desert with lots of possessions for doubt, the fifth one. But being a slave, it's almost like all of them together. It's like being in prison, but you don't get to stay in your little cell. You have to work for someone else, and you don't get to decide how. There's not the creativity. Can we take it in? Can we really absorb that possibility? That there is that slavery in us. That there are the ways that we're not self-dependent, that we are dependent on others. What are the ways? What is it that shoves us around and makes us always put off what's most important and precious for us? Till we've earned that time off, so to say. What doesn't let us feel that we have our own lives and that there's vastness in it? And that there's so much of beauty and subtlety and clarity and love that's already in us and with us in our lives that we are simply unaware of. We're not receiving those inputs. We're not receiving those orders. We're just receiving orders from the one master. So feeling for ourselves, what is that? And also feeling for the moments where there is the being released from slavery. An equally wonderful, in a few words, image, very powerful. The moments in our own experience today where there was a slight or great sense of being released from slavery. I didn't have to do what I thought I had to do. There could be rest. I could do what I thought I couldn't do. I could have that conversation that I was afraid to have. Or I could just stay silent. Or I could just walk into the hall. Are there any questions or comments so far? Again, really welcome. If we can take this as something that's in our experience, and it's just simple experience, ordinary experience, even if slavery is something we would like to end. If we can let the image be powerful, let the experience have its significance, when we notice we're a slave to an idea, and it's not letting aliveness come through. It's not my genuine opinion, even. I'm just repeating something I heard that I didn't even check out where it came from. And once it's out of our mouth, And who heard it and heard that kind of edge to the voice and took it as true and passed it on? And when you wanted to call it back because you realized you didn't even agree with that thing that you said, it didn't actually come with your own experience. It's really hard to bring all those threads back, that net that's come out. Equally important, the statements in our mind. We let them have place, and we let them dominate. So if it can be fun to keep finding ways to escape from slavery, to escape from when you just notice that gesture or that word or that opinion that's actually not even yours. If you really just check for a moment, it's inauthentic, or you're not sure, then wouldn't it be more honest to say, I don't know, or to feel and let your body communicate not knowing and ease with not knowing? And just feeling in that, isn't there an undisciplined order that comes? Isn't there a harmony that starts to be possible that wasn't possible before? So these little gestures are important and ordinary and little. So that means it's really possible in any moment, even if for 100 years in that situation you reacted that way. It's just an ordinary situation still. And it's already possible to let another movement come through. When we allow a different kind of movement to happen, so going back to the poem Unmarked Boxes, this undisciplined order, the disobedient harmony or flow. Not being tied to the stake. We let go of that stake that we ourselves somehow have planted as if it's outside of me, to judge me, to watch me, to control me. And we realize it's all happening. It's a movement in my mind, in my own mind. Let it happen and let me disbelieve it. This allows a mind inwardly peaceful, in the words of that teaching about restlessness. And as the mind becomes inwardly peaceful, we're happy to stay in that peacefulness, even if we don't have company there sometimes. We don't require company to confirm that this is peace, because the inwardly peaceful quality is so fresh and so nourishing, so much happening by itself. So in the poem Unmarked Boxes, the movements from rain into the flower bed, up as flowers, and in all these different forms that we experience. Moving from cell to cell, unmarked box to unmarked box. As we grow our ability for steadiness, so that we can just simply meet these ordinary moments of slavery, of selfishness, of whatever, of depth, of vastness. And we grow our trust. So we grow our steadiness and we grow our trust through experience that life is possible. Truly living is possible. We don't need to add any special quality to make it so. It already is livable. Then we can be ready to give up the boxes that aliveness passes through, just letting it be passed. There's another poem I would love to share, called Luna. By Mary Oliver. She's a living woman in the United States. And this particular book is called Why I Wake Early. As we gain confidence in allowing the ordinary, natural, spontaneous movement of aliveness in our lives, so not theoretically, but in our daily, ordinary lives, we feel the power of that. We feel the sensitivity that's awakened as that harmony, that fluid harmony, comes in. And a kind of intelligence that awakens through the sensitivity. That can really feel the difference between movement that's tied to the stake of past, that's tied to a stake of being watched, that seems to be being watched by them or him or her outside me. It's actually in my own psyche. And we start to grow in confidence through our love of being touched and being moved. And all that is possible, all that we are more aware of that's already present in our lives, that we were blind to when we were fixated on thinking about ourselves so much. So leaving room for feeling ourselves and being moved in our lives. Luna. In the early curtains of the dusk. Dusk is about this time of day. The light is starting to fade. In the early curtains of the dusk, it flew. A slow galloping. This way and that way, through the trees and under the trees. I live in the open-mindedness of not knowing enough. So I'm just going to tell you, because with the English it's not, you may not know. So she's talking about a moth, which is like the nighttime butterfly, called Luna moth. It's a big green moth. Galloping is what we usually talk about horses doing when they go as fast as they can. It flew, a slow galloping, this way and that way, through the trees and under the trees. I live in the open-mindedness of not knowing enough about anything. When we're less concerned to know about things, it's possible, and we're at ease with that. That ease takes us somewhere where more knowing, a different kind of knowing, is possible. So a knowing of beauty, for example, intimacy with beauty. The open-mindedness of not knowing enough about anything. It was beautiful. It was silent. It didn't even have a mouth. But it wanted something, it had a purpose, and a few precious hours to find it. And I suppose it did. The next evening, it lay on the ground like a broken leaf and didn't move, which hurt my heart. Which is another small thing that doesn't know much. When this happened, it was about the middle of summer, which also has its purposes and only so many precious hours. How quietly, and not with any assignment from us, or even a small hint of understanding. Everything that needs to be done is done. I'll just read the end again. The next evening, it lay on the ground like a broken leaf and didn't move, which hurt my heart, which is another small thing that doesn't know much. Feeling how letting the heart be a small thing that doesn't need to know much, that has another kind of knowing. In the knowing, there can be hurt that brings our love wider, which is what we need to do, what we can do. We already know how to make the love small. We can practice appreciation of the moth and its movements in that time of day. And where we can feel the edge of our growing, letting the love grow and be stretched. In the letting go. So, which hurt my heart, which is another small thing that doesn't know much. You see, the not knowing much is not a value judgment. It's a freedom to be ordinary, to be moved. When this happened, it was about the middle of summer, which also has its purposes and only so many precious hours. How quietly, and not with any assignment from us, or even a small hint of understanding, everything that needs to be done is done. We can value our live living and ordinary movements, that ordinary not as a put down, but as a freedom. To give up the need to be special, the need for approval, the need for an idea to confirm what is already so beautifully happening, and is beautiful in the happening, and is necessary. And the more participation we allow of the depths of our being in that, even when there's not a smallest hint of understanding what's going on, through our feeling of it, there can stay the trust, the thread of trust, and the steadiness. So that when we come across the obstacles that will come as part of that, what needs to be done, getting done. Our receiving of the obstacle as not right and not wrong, as even a sign of breakthrough, without holding to the opposite of the obstacle, restlessness, rest, just as it is, ordinary, and letting that aliveness get untied from the stake of past and judgment, trusting the power of the moment, the power of our depth of being, to find its way, to do what needs to be done. So we're not avoiding, pretending harmony. But letting that living deeply free our love and free our movement and free our lives. Is there any question or comment before we end? May we give over the direction of our lives, not to our thinking, but to that open-mindedness that doesn't know enough about anything. And is willing to be moved. Towards freedom. May our practice and our lives participate fully in the momentum towards liberation for all.